maybe we're actually going to podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I've got about 30 minutes at this point, and then I'm going to bed because I've got to be up early.
And we have plenty to talk about.
Okay, well, let's cover that stuff first, and then we can bullshit, or you guys can bullshit after I get off.
I want to talk about your dick, and then somehow fit that in there.
What's that?
Your dick, the red, with the fervid vision, or fevered visions.
Oh, that's not my deck, dude. That deck just, either won or was like in the top eight of a SCG 2 weeks ago.
He's brought in all the visions out of the board.
No, they're in the main deck. And it just so happens that it's an even better decision now with Seasons Past dominating, because that can't beat that card.
It's also actually moving a little bit price-wise.
Well, yeah, on Magic Online, it was up to like a dollar or something, and then went down to 25 cents, and it went back up to 85 cents today.
Yeah, no, it's been all over the place. I've got my place up for that deck and stuff. I don't know, MTGO finance, I know better as of the past 2 weeks than I do. I didn't pay attention to any real-world finance this weekend, but I can tell you everything that happened to MTGO prices. I was watching all that shit, like market ticker by the minute.
All right, let's jump into this real quick. Let's go.
Jason, are you here?
What do you mean? All right. I'm here the whole fucking time.
I just didn't hear you in the last few minutes. I don't know if you slept out.
Are you sure? I've been gone for a whole half hour. Are you sure you're still here?
We've been on the call for 50 minutes.
It's
been a lot longer than that, but that's fine.
Well, let's do a rolling start. Everybody, listen to the pain and suffering that's going on with my co-host. I'm sitting here because I forgot my laptop at work. So I'm using my lady's laptop, and I had to update Skype. Now, Ryan has done this before, but not under the pressure like we are, because we're under the pressure, because Ryan's got to get out of here. He's in Kentucky. He's on the grind. He's doing that magic finance in real life, in real time, going on right now. So we're going to have to lose him in about 30 minutes, so the cast may be cut a little bit short. I'm Marcel MTG. You can find me on Twitter. That's the only place you can find me at. I don't write articles. I don't do any of that other stuff. Maybe streaming, maybe, but I got a baby, so that's probably not going to ever happen. Who knows? But we have Corbin. Corbin here, he actually streams once in a while. How are you doing, Corbin?
Yeah, what's up, guys? I do occasionally stream. Like to do it more in my life. You can channel is CHostler88, same as my Twitter name.
CHostler88. Why did you choose 88, obviously, the year you were born?
That is correct, yeah.
That's
pretty complicated, really.
Lame. It's two infinity symbols sideways.
You could have done anything else and disagreed with what I had to say, but no.
No one's going to make the obvious joke. All right.
Okay. Anyway, so the next guy, what's the obvious joke?
I don't know what the obvious joke is, but...
88 in the white supremacist movement is HH, because it's the eighth letter of the alphabet.
Nobody knew that but you.
Yeah, that's
everybody
not really,
knows that.
Nobody I wouldn't label that an obvious joke.
Yeah, see, you live in Michigan, so it might be obvious in Michigan. And Oklahoma, actually, Oklahoma's a little bit more progressive.
Klan down there. That's true.
They're very, like, you know, closed-minded, but they do not have the Klan down there.
That's because they don't have the internet to get organized. They don't know where to meet each other.
All right, so this is our resident. This is our resident comedian, or so he would like to think he is. This is
yeah,
Jason.
You should
Neal.
Probably cut all that. By the way, that probably needs to not be on the podcast.
Okay. Anyway, so moving on, we have the baby face assassin, the guy that everyone wants to hear from. He made fevered visions a thing, or so he says. He put it in the main board, and he has a picture that he texts to us with four fevered visions on the in play on the battlefield, ripping it apart. Tell us about
four
it.
Four copies of it. That feels like a clock.
It was good. No, the card's fantastic, and I'm definitely not taking credit for this. That's two major things you've tried to give me credit for so far in this cast that are I can't take credit for.
Yeah, earlier, Marcel, you're like, show us your deck, and Ryan's like, oh, it's definitely not my deck. Definitely not my tech. There's a list I found online. I just boarded in the feed revisions.
Yeah, it's literally, I'm pretty sure it's like was it Joel Larson's deck? Joel Larson, whatever.
But he had them in the sideboard. It takes balls to take
them. No, they were in the main deck.
No, they were they?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were in the main deck, because I was like, that was why I liked his version over Todd Anderson's, because I was like, ooh, these are in the main. I really love this. And the more I play that, the less I like Thing in the Ice. I'm actually looking at trying to build a three-color version. Like, I am tuning this. Thing in the Ice is just not I don't know, everyone's gunning with, like, Grasp of Darkness, and the deck already has so few creatures that, like, you're just opening up the removal and that card's always dying. I'm thinking about taking those out and just building into, like, more removal so you can kind of keep up with some of the earlier matchups a little better than you can now. So I am tuning it, but I've probably put in probably, like, 2 or 3 dozen matches with it so far this weekend, and I've really enjoyed it. I've been playing a lot of leagues and stuff. I'm really loving the MTGO leagues. Both sealed and standard. That is a huge boon to be able to play and actually, like, you know, do competitive rather than having time for a daily and stuff like that. So.
Careful, Ryan. You're getting dangerously close to praising Wizards of the Coast.
It's not like this they do, week. It's like they do things correctly at times, and then it's like other times they do things really incorrectly. And the other thing you're giving me credit for, going down to – I'm doing real finance and driving down to Kentucky. That's about 10% true. I'm going down to Troll and Toad because I have a lot of cards worth a lot of money that I want to sell to them because their prices are really good on them. However, I refuse to do it through the mail.
I'm sorry. If that is not real finance, I really don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
I'm not buying cards. I'm literally like going to get their list numbers. I'm just refused to do it not in person. So I will spend the extra $400 to sell the cards.
Finance 101, you could take a trip down and sell them instead of shipping them because you have so much cards that you need to rent an 18-wheeler to get down there?
Oh, no, that was the bulk. That was to St. Louis. This is like, we could fit everything that we're taking in a 4K. However, the amount of money worth of cards in that 4K is worth about 10 times what that bulk was worth. So that's why I'm doing it in person. I'm not mailing that much money in cards. It's just not happening.
All right.
Not to Troll and Toad. Probably not to any company, but definitely not to Troll and
definitely
Toad.
Definitely not Troll and Toad. I'll take their money, but I'm not going to trust them.
So yeah, that,
exactly.
That's well, strong that's, rhetoric
the
right
honest,
there.
The honest, you know, opinion of Ryan here, on which is actually, I think something a lot of people care about is knowing what dealers are reputable to deal with and so on and so forth.
No.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem with Troll and Toad is, like, they just have such a disconnect. And, I mean, they've moved through so many employees the last number of years. Their entire buying department, as far as their shows goes, completely switched over. I don't want to say that they're not trustworthy. I think it's just there's too many moving pieces right now, and until they get everything reorganized, I'm just not willing to believe that things won't get lost or misplaced or
things happen. I've had, you know, their prices are usually very good, but I have also had some negative experiences with their list where, you know, the check doesn't arrive in the mail and then they try to charge me a replacement fee. You know, like I'm at fault for them not sending me a check. It's like me demanding they pay for my cards when my cards don't arrive in the mail. That's actually something that's happened to me twice with them.
Ooh, huh. Yeah.
See, I never have issues with them. But, I mean, I also assume it's one of those things where, like, I send them enough stuff so they would recognize the name of the package to attempt not to fuck that up. So it's probably not the same for most people, and that's why I can't really speak as to, like, sending them stuff as a general person. I mean, if they know who you are, then absolutely use Troll and Toad. If they don't know who you are, I can't really say that that's a great idea because I've heard way too many horror stories.
So who would you recommend? Who's on the short list that you would say that you can pretty much trust? You may not get the maximum value.
Card Advantage.
For sure.
Thomas.
We all use Card Advantage quite a bit because, you know, Thomas is great to work with and we've all had good experiences there.
Card Kingdom through the mail. I've never had bad experience dealing with them through the mail.
The only thing I don't like about Card Kingdom is they don't give you a chance to get your cards back after they deduct them. They just pay you for them.
No, that's not true.
They promise it's not.
They've asked me if I wanted them to send my stuff back before, and
correct.
I usually
that's been my experience.
That's
also.
It's just standard.
Maybe they recognize the name on the package, Ryan.
It's also plausible that under my account, I just told them at one point to push everything through, and then I don't get contacted for it. But yeah, no, like there's sometimes when I just I just disagree with their grading. Like they're super harsh on stuff. But it's also part of their model. It's part of the new Star City model, too, is put really high prices on their buy list, get the cards, grade them down, pay you less, so it actually averages out to, like, what everyone else is paying. And I don't know. It just depends on what you're selling to. Like, to say there's one best store out there is just incorrect. Like, if you're selling a bunch of high-end dual lands, you probably want to sell those to a very different store than you do your $5 standard cards.
So where would you?
There are places that I
people
I
are taking notes.
Preferentially,
Card Kingdom is a very good place to sell standard stuff to. It's a good place to sell modern stuff to.
Anything up to $50 is great. Card Kingdom. Anything from 5 cents to $50, that's the place I would be looking at first.
Jason, what about you? What about your experiences?
I mean, it's been the same. There's some stores that I'll deal with in person that I won't deal with through the mail. Like I'll wait 20 minutes in line to deal with Strike Zone, you know, at like a GP, but I don't really like mailing them my stuff. I have a very different experience mailing them stuff.
That is not a place you want to mail stuff to.
Yeah, I would also, now that Chris no longer works for Strike Zone, I would probably just go deal with MTG Deals.
Yeah.
That's Chris and Paul and Charles are, and I mean, they've all treated me very well. I've been good friends with Chris for a number of years, and I like dealing with them. They would be one of my recommendations for the high-end stuff, for sure.
Yeah, I've never been disappointed dealing with Deals, that's for sure.
Paul's been on the cast, right? He was actually a guest at one point that we should probably get
back.
Yeah,
we had Paul on forever ago.
Yeah, and we've tried to get Chris on. I still should make that happen some week. I mean, I'm sure we could get like Charles on too at some point, but then it just seems like we're pushing their store, I guess, which is fine. I mean, they've always done well, and I like supporting stores that seem to support the community, and they do a lot of things. They actually had some guys on coverage. Any of those shirts you said that said Dex on them? That's a subsidiary company of theirs, I believe. They're affiliated at the very
least. They are affiliated.
Yeah.
Also, I think, you know, as far as the bigger stores go, I mean, I've never had a bad experience with Channel Fireball Star City. I tend to have a fairly, you know, reasonable opinion of those stores.
I remember
City took me forever to get my last check, like 2 months.
Shoot, I remember, what was it, Jersey, where we had a bunch of dual lands. You waited 2 hours in line, and we were fucking hungover and wanted to leave. And they gave you an insulting number, and it was just like you wanted to throw the cards in their face or something.
Yeah, it was a waste of time. But, I mean, that also comes down to the only like negative thing I will say about Star City in person is I feel like they have a high turnover in their staff. And I feel like there's a lot of people who are not qualified to be a buyer who end up buying for them. And I think the problem is they don't really have training shows necessarily. Like, if you're working in a normal company, you've got a lot of like things like anime shows, small PPTQs, whatever, where you can train those kinds of people to get them up to speed. And I feel like SCG maybe doesn't do that, because I've dealt with a couple of their buyers who, just not knowing their list, it just seemed really unprofessional. They had to do a lot of things that you're just kind of expected to know how to do, and you shouldn't have to look them up all the time. And I was a little disappointed, but at the same time, I've dealt with people from Star City who, when they know what they're doing, it's a great process. I mean, the prices are fine if you know what you want to keep and what you want to get rid of. And I have no complaints about that. So, like, really my biggest complaint is I feel like they just maybe don't necessarily put the most staff training in before they let them go on the floor.
Interesting. Well, there you go. I guess that's a quick... I mean, the general thing, though, is just if you're dealing with people online, know who you're dealing with. Good experiences, personally, I can speak to Adventures On, ABU Games, Card Kingdom, obviously Card Advantage.
ARG.
I've not dealt with them myself.
That's fair.
All right.
I haven't dealt with Adventures On in a while either, but... But yeah, no, there's plenty of good reputable stores out there, and I mean, any of the stores we've listed off here seem fine to ship cards to.
All right, so now there's been more important things that happen in Magic. Like,
were there?
I can pretty much bet on this because what the biggest thing that happened this weekend is that the Platinum Pros just got screwed over. There's nothing else more important.
We're going to jump to first.
Yeah, that's. I mean, this is part of the problem is that the Pro Tour was overshadowed by this. So absolutely, let's do it.
Shadow over the Pro Tour. It was actually what's his name? I can't even. Embercool. Embercool came over and he annihilated all the benefit. Oh, is it she?
It is a she.
I apologize. I have been corrected.
Sexist.
Always assuming the big bad's a guy. I see how it is.
Hashtag not every Eldrazi.
Ah.
Well, anyway, Embercruel, she cast her shadow upon the land over Berlin, right? That's where the Pro Tour was at?
No, it was in Madrid. Come on, man.
He got the wrong city in Germany. Whatever, he was pretty close.
He was just hoping it was like some sort of dirigible joke. I don't know where you're going with that.
No.
All the humanity!
Anyway, So what happened? The worst thing that could ever possibly happen. The worst thing, the most worst thing. But it's actually very bad if you think about it. There's many layers to it. But the pros, the Platinum Pros, they got their appearance fees cut down from $3,000 each Pro Tour to $250. So over the course of a year, that equals out to about $11,000. And this is already midstream, as they're already three quarters of the way on their way to completing their goal towards Platinum for next year. So this is very underhanded, especially that part of it. Myself, I don't like it. There's people that say this is not a big deal because it affects only, 34 people, and that there will be people that will aspire to be pros. And if we had a constant revolving, stream of pros, that may be better for the game. What do you guys feel about that?
I mean, that's true in some capacity, but you also, and I mean, I don't want to drag a bunch of other esports into this because though there are comparisons and good analogies, there are also just as many bad ones. But if you look at like something like League, which is one of the only esports I actually keep up with, while there are definitely new talent hitting the scene at all times, you also consistently have your wild turtles and like just players like that who have been around for years. Even if they're on a different team, they're still there. They're still like, pulling those same positions. They're still consistently like, when you're watching like him play as an ADC, that like it's going to be a good game from his perspective. And I think that's important as well. But I also do understand wanting to bring in that young blood. I don't necessarily think this is the best way to do that. And I think there's a lot of ways you could incentivize the newer player without necessarily having to alienate the, stable, already established.
So you think the goal here is that they want to, they're okay with driving out some of the current.
If they don't have
the current class, is that what you're saying, Ryan?
No, I'm not. I was just speaking to what he said. My opinion's very different on all of this.
I think if they don't,
that could be like,
if they're not trying to, if they're not going to like revise their stance, or there's an additional things they haven't revealed, I honestly think that the way that is currently structured and they presented it will drive away people. It's happening already. We see that the Vinci's Super League is being restructured. Some people may be dropping out. I don't know if it's in protest or in actually them, them just being, I'm done with the game because of this, but there will be an impact. And to say that, if they don't do something other than what they're currently presenting, it will drive people out of the game.
Oh, they absolutely are going to. And there are two outcomes, really. It's either they pretend that this was the plan all along, in which case they're terrible at communicating their goals to us, or they're doing some pretty slick backpedaling, in which case they probably should have talked to some people before they announced this policy change. If the community was going to be as categorically against it as they are this. So either way, they seem a little tone deaf with this announcement. And again, Helene Bergeau was the one who had to make the announcement. She got thrown under the bus, and I bet being on Twitter for her has just been the worst for like the last couple days. So that's got to suck. I'm sure this wasn't all her idea, but she's getting all the crap for it. So sorry.
So let's try to take this, I guess, one issue at a time. And the first is the timing. So they have one Pro Tour left this season, which will be, a couple months from now. And then the season ends, and everybody who achieved Platinum this season is that for the next year, regardless of how they do next year. And that's where they're making money. So the issue with the timing is that these people have been doing these things this year with this expected payoff at the end, where they will make – this money at all these events next year. And obviously now that won't be the case. They will not make this money next year because of what Wizards is doing here with this announcement. So the way to look at this is those people essentially paid their way this year with the expectation of a payoff next year, and now they're not going to get it. So I think – and this seems to be the line most people come down on, is that Wizards hopefully will – roll this out and push it back where it doesn't roll out until the year after that. So everybody who does make Platinum this year is actually given their benefits.
At the very least, that's what they should do. If they decide to hold on to everything else, that's okay. At the very least, they got extended benefits to next year. Even though written within the contract, they're not obligated, and the rules could change at any point. the community goodwill of extending the benefits is worth whatever dollars they expect to save by not extending the benefits, in my opinion.
No, absolutely. I mean, you'd think that it had been, would have been discussed before this. I don't know. So now I guess we all are pretty much in agreement on that. Let's talk about the effect this will have and what that means. I mean, I think we can all agree that this will drive some number of players away. The question is, if you're Wizards of the Coast, you know, they don't want that. But at the same time, let's not pretend that there aren't players out there who will be happy for their opportunity to step up, and they'll have other ways of funding themselves. And like, there will always be people who want to play professional Magic, and they did a lot of damage to themselves with this, and it hurts that dream for people knowing that the payoff at the end wasn't what they thought it would be. But, you know, long term, I don't think Magic is dead because of this. So where do you guys see things going from here?
See, Matt Sperling had an interesting article, and it actually brought to light the fact that, you know, there's a lawsuit going on with the judges that Wizards is the employer of them. They actually have a strong case.
Judges do not have a strong case, but that's a different topic.
No, I'll show you some articles later on that they actually, like...
They don't work for Wizards of the Coast, man.
They control their employment. They control their terms of employment. They control how they're promoted.
They're not employed.
Yeah. They're not
Nobody
employed.
Thinks they have a strong case. The article you cited for Matt doesn't think they have a strong case.
All right. Well,
yeah, I can't see it.
Not a strong case. Okay. So regardless of strong case, either way, they brought out some stuff to light that there's ways that things can be perceived as an employment. Maybe this was a step to distance themselves from the potential of pro players going around the same lines as this could be.
Even Matt Sperling admitted that sounds like a conspiracy theory in the article that you read, and I tend to agree.
That said, I think that it is certainly a conspiracy theory at this point, but let's at least talk it through, because a lot of people probably, care to some extent about it. It's possible that pros actually had a stronger case than the judges did, because they are actually paid. You know, they make money to show up at a specific event run by Wizards of the Coast to do these things. And it's very different than judges in that sense. And, you know, everyone should go read Matt's article if you are interested in this. But is it possible that, you know, given the things, like, you think Wizards really wanted to upstage their own pro tour by announcing this when they did? So either they're just really, truly that tone deaf, which I don't know if you believe or not. Or there was something from above that sort of mandated it. That sort of matched gist. I mean, what do you guys think about that?
Matt, I don't know. Matt says that the pros have a pretty good...
That's what I'm saying.
...case for a promissory estoppel, which is... I mean, I'm not a contract lawyer, but it's basically if you act in reliance on a promise, you can basically sue for the enforcement of that promise. So I would think at least for this season, there's a good promissory estoppel case they acted in the rest of the season.
He addressed that. They have the disclaimer.
Yeah.
It's in the disclaimer.
It's in the contract they signed.
That changes anything.
There's some stuff you can't just hand wave away like that, though.
If you sign your name to it and you say, like Keisha, she's in this contract that she wants to get out of, she signed her name on there and the courts won't let her out of it. There's a lot of power to signing your name to a contract.
That's a better case than the judges, if you ask me.
Well, yeah. Okay. I'm saying, though, that signing your name on the paperwork does have, you know, you know what you're getting yourself into. It's hard to argue at that point.
So, I mean, but let's addressing the point. I mean, do you guys think that this is a legal thing by Wizards, or do you think that this is, as sort of my take on it, is this they wanted to increase the money on the World Championships? Somewhere along the line, whether that was within Wizards, whether that was from Hasbro, whatever, someone said, we're not just going to up the money this much. There has to be a cut.
And then, I think the upping of the money wasn't the egg here. I think it was the chicken sort of a deal. I think that was something they said, hey, we'll cut almost $1 million out of the prize payouts, but we'll add 150 grand here or whatever they're adding. Like the math doesn't really add up.
Well, the math certainly does not add up particularly well.
So I don't think – I think that's more of like, oh, but look, there's money here. So is it – you know, that was the plan all along. I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that was just like some lame concession they made, so it doesn't look quite like they're taking a ton of money out of the overall prize pool, which is it's essentially what they're doing.
So do you why do you think that then they made a decision at all? Because to a company as large as Hasbro that makes as much money as Magic does, I mean, it certainly seems like the negative PR generated by this does not offset the cost savings.
I don't know. Wizards has done so much dumb crap, it's hard to say that they would know better, but this almost seems like Hasbro is twisting their arm. But maybe that's just me wanting to see, you know, the good in it. I just, this it's such a baffling decision, and the timing's so weird that it's almost like, why are they doing this?
Well, if it doesn't get reversed.
From their advertising budget, that's where this money was coming from before. So,
well, I think you can legitimately make the case that having a larger world championship prize pool is a better use of advertising dollars than paying the guy who goes 4-4 or 3-5 and drops from day one of the Pro Tour $3,000 from being there. You get a lot more headlines in ESPN, eSports, and all these places where they want to grow Magic by having this giant prize pool attached to the World Championship than you do by supporting the players at the top.
Yeah, but
someone who doesn't understand Magic culture would say, they come in and is like, explain to me why we're paying these guys $3,000, like some Hasbro employee that's like on a new Wizards board, and they're like, oh, well, it's because of this. He's like, that's stupid. Why don't you just make your biggest tournament like poker? Make Magic more like poker. And they're like,
well, the analog in esports is, and it's interesting because Ryan brought up League of Legends earlier, and I follow a lot of these esports very closely. League of Legends takes the approach Magic did have, where they require teams that are in the LCS to pay their players a minimum salary that Riot itself provides. The goal is to create stability for the players so that they stick around and that these teams can grow their brand, and they don't just want to throw it all in one giant thing. Dota, on the other hand, all of their money all year long, and they take giant things for giant sponsorships for this one tournament. They have one huge tournament every year that has an eye-popping number attached to it, and it's huge. It's absolutely a big deal. And the team that wins that makes, you know, $1 million or whatever, and it's great for them. And the team that does not have a is a good team but has a bad tournament there makes very little. And in League of Legends and Dota have gone opposite directions on that, and it seems like with this, Wizards is shifting towards the Dota style of things. And like I said, from a purely advertising standpoint and generating interest and headlines, you can make that case. Now, obviously, I don't think any of us think that the damage to the player base justifies that. But, you know, it's just very interesting because there you can make that case from a pure numbers standpoint. Again, it seems like a lot of things that come out of Wizards where the PR team was not given a lot of, I mean, because, you know, I have a PR degree, so I care about these things. If I'm sitting there in a PR role in that company, I'm like, I understand these things you're saying to me, advertising guy, and they're all true. However, let me tell you about how the public's going to react and how much that's going to cost us in goodwill, et cetera, yeah, et cetera. But so, we've never seen that be a big deal in the way it seems like Wizards approaches things.
Yeah, they don't care per se as such. But if you do see a reversal in this decision, then you're more likely to conclude that Wizards came up with this. And if there is like a stern, firm factor, then this is probably a Hasbro down decision. But yeah, as the Pro Tour and somebody won the Pro Tour, but we don't know his name. He's Steve forgotten.
We know Steve Rubin.
I know,
what's
but
Steve Rubin's name.
Exactly. But it just seemed like he got overshadowed by this. This happened, what, before the final?
See, I got lucky. I turned off coverage as soon as coverage was done. And I don't remember this announcement happening. Like, I didn't find out about this until, like, I don't know, late last night. So, yeah. No, that was great. I got to actually enjoy the Pro Tour, which the top 8 was fantastic. Like, it was star-studded. There was a bunch of different decks. If you didn't watch the Pro Tour, you made a mistake.
Yeah, I wish I did. Yeah, 8 different decks in the top 8, the Magic Online Gauntlet, the Pro Tour Gauntlet's actually going to be interesting this time. You're not going to have mostly Eldrazi and maybe a Burn deck in there in the top 8 like they did with the last time. So this is actually going to be pretty cool. The interesting part, though, is there's no Thought-Not Seers in anywhere close near the top 8. The Eldrazi is not an impact.
Wasn't the red-white Eldrazi deck running them?
the Google or goggles, Googles. The one that it lost in the first round, but I swore that deck was running Thought Knots.
Maybe I'm mistaken. Oh,
if
man.
Only we could see a top eight.
I'm going
we
to look
type
right
that
now.
Into Google. If only that
I'm yeah, most I'm likely going. Wrong. Yeah. So well, anyway, Marcel is wrong.
But if it was in one deck, great. Like it's you would expect a lot more with the way the pros are talking about it. So like even just being between one and four copies in the top eight just seems like a little bit of an underperformance.
Yeah,
not that every deck was really geared to running. Like I think a lot of people were testing Thing in the Ice and Thought Not Seeing Thing in the Ice aren't necessarily going to go in the same deck.
There wasn't really a Thing of the Ice decks either. I mean, they existed, but they weren't a huge percentage of the field.
The biggest innovation...
Yeah, especially not in the top eight. You know, those decks weren't really doing that well.
Well, to me, the interesting thing is that there were some people actually talking about how unbeatable Bank Company was and how it was just, you know, this absurd deck that it was just unfair and ruined Standard, et cetera, et
cetera.
Heard
it called Fairies, yeah.
Yeah, and just, come on. Just that is clearly, as it turns out... not the case. Standard actually seems in a good. I mean, honestly, the sad part is this was such a great pro tour. It was a completely star-studded lineup, and there were eight different decks in the top eight for Standard. Like, that's insane. We should be, you know, using this time to celebrate Wizards and all of these things, and instead, you know, we're talking about the changes to Platinum. It's just, it feels bad because this should be a time where Wizards is actually getting credit.
Yeah.
And we should be talking about Enter the Battlefield, the documentary by Nate and Sean from Walking the Plains, which is great. And that's not what we're getting to do. So it just all feels, yeah, you know, for most of us, it just feels very rough.
Yeah, they could have just, like, whoever's on PR could have just thought this out just a little bit.
Well, I think it's likely PR does not have a lot of say.
But, I mean, they could have waited till after the pro, or after Walking the Plains or, you know, they already could have debuted entering, you know, Walking the Plains. You know, maybe before the Pro Tour, so people could be all excited about going Platinum and then just have their whole bubble bursted.
Well, they should have had a showing at the Pro Tour, right? That would have been cool.
Some combination of such. It just seems like they threw a wet blanket right in the middle of the party, and it was party foul central.
The timing of the announcement is almost as egregious as the announcement itself.
Yeah.
There you go.
There it goes.
I guess that's how we all feel about it.
So Season Pass. A card that we
really
called
sad. I like
Bulk.
I had a rant.
Seasons Pass, a card that we called Bulk, turned out to be the hottest shit at
the Well, you never know when people are going to want to do EDH shit in Standard, right? Sometimes, like, you Pyromancer's Goggles in Standard, and I was like, what is this EDH shit? Well, that's why I play EDH. I do stuff like that every game. So, yeah. Seasons Past and Dark Petition or whatever? Yeah,
Dark Petition is the one that took me by surprise.
Hey, whatever.
Seasons Past, you can see the power. I mean, it gets back a lot of cards. It's a great curve topper. But the first week of Standard certainly gave us no indication that a control deck that played green was going to be viable. You know, all we saw were these Bank Company decks and Cubans and all this hardcore aggro, and I expected
white everywhere. Yeah,
yeah, I expected a lot of board wipes and languages and stuff at the Pro Tour. So I expected control to make an appearance. I just certainly would not affect Seasons Past in it.
Yeah, I think Dark Petition had been picking up a little bit in play the last couple of weeks. Anyway, the Seasons Past was definitely an interesting addition to that. I really liked Seth Manfield's deck, the Esper Control, single creature, only Sphinx of the Final Hour word.
Yeah,
also a card we called it Bulk, and will probably remain a Bulk. Don't get excited about this. It being a one of, I don't think has any real financial implications long term.
I didn't think Pearllake Ancient would go up, and I was wrong about that.
Well, it went up for like a day, and then
it was Bulk the rest of its life, even though it was still played. And that's the problem, is like a one of in a control deck that is not the most dominant control deck in the format is not going to necessarily drive things.
Yeah, look at Aetherling. You know, Aetherling, yeah. It was as good as we all thought and still did nothing financially.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult even at Mythic to hit that point, especially in this format, because we've already got just in this top eight, not only do you have that control deck and the Seasons Pass control deck, you have a hardcore dedicated Esper Dragons control deck as well. So even if you want to be an Esper, you have to decide which version of control you want to be, which is also very cool that you can have an exact same color combination and have two very different archetypes. I'm in love with this standard format. I will be playing the heck out of it.
Yeah, but do you really think that players are going to play one of these decks, or do you think everyone's going to play the same old Bant Company nonsense?
I don't think anybody wants to play the Bant Company mirror.
The Bant Company deck has holes. I mean, it's definitely a very good deck. It definitely can beat a lot of these other decks. But as you tune more of these decks to be able to like target that, which I mean is a big part of what they did for the Pro Tour, you're going to learn those edges. And the other problem with the Bant Company deck is it's very unforgiving. If you make one mistake, you're gone. Like, you're going to get wrecked by a board wipe, something like that. And you have to play it so meticulously and so carefully. And so, like, if you're just playing for MTGO or if you're just playing FNM or whatnot, playing that deck is pretty miserable because it's very unforgiving.
You never know what your collected company is going to do. And like,
well, there's that too. Yeah, I mean, sometimes, like, if you whiff on a collected company, there's no worse feeling. I did it last season playing Rally, and oh my goodness, it's just you just feel miserable. Like, you just lost the game in one fell swoop. And so, like, that being a factor is also not enjoyable. But I think not everybody wants to play that mid-rangey kind of deck. Even if it is very good and you have all the tools and Abyssin is a great card and all these other things that stack up to make that a very popular and very powerful deck, you're going to have hardcore dedicated control players who are now salivating that they have two to three different deck choices. You're going to have aggro players who aren't just stuck at white humans. Now they have this green-white token deck to look at and all these other things. You have, you know, ramp players who are afraid that, oh, you know, ramp was coming into this as one of the biggest hype decks coming into the season, and it saw nothing because it was just shut out by all these really fast aggro decks. Well, finally we have this Goggles ramp deck and this red-white Eldrazi ramp deck that can both compete with these aggro decks while at the same time having a better late game than a lot of the decks that are maybe just hardcore set out to beat those aggro decks. I really, like I said, I was just impressed. Like, we saw every archetype represented in that top eight. We saw multiple decks crossing each archetype. And then we saw some decks that we absolutely didn't expect, like the Seasons Pass deck. And I don't know what more you can ask on top of the fact that the names in that top eight were fantastic.
I mean, that's what you want from Pro Tour Magic. You want them innovating.
Yeah. I mean, everyone expects that out of Brad Nelson, but and like, you know, even the Finkel. But I don't know. If nothing else, this Pro Tour absolutely solidified and sold me on the double rotation. That is a huge factor for seeing these kinds of results, because anytime there's a big difference between adding a set and dropping two sets and adding a set. And this just goes to show you how big of a difference that makes. And not only that, but like, so many people were convinced that Standard was solved with the two SCGs, especially one of them being an Invitational where you expect a lot of people to bring out everything. And not only wasn't it solved, we didn't even see iterations of these decks. Like, these decks were so under the radar. Some of these decks didn't come to light until the week of the Pro Tour. Some of these guys who were talking about them said, like, yeah, just somebody, you know, figured this deck out and we just jammed it as soon as we saw what was happening at the SCG, and boom, here we are. Like, you know, these weren't decks that people have been secretly working on for weeks in some cases. Like, this is still innovation happening. And that means next week, there's still going to be somebody sitting there going, okay, what do I do? How do I tackle this format? I expect us to see another half a dozen archetypes before this format's over, like, that resemble nothing like we have now. There's a very powerful pool of cards right now in Standard, and we are in a format where we have enough removal to keep the aggro decks down, and we have enough different things we can be doing as a control deck or a mid-range deck to make it a very diverse metagame.
Okay, so say you're a Magic player. What are you doing financially to get ready for the fact that we're going to see a lot more sea changes in the metagame? Does it become more important to like get your mana bases handled and get those staples as opposed to buying the card for the deck because they're going to be a little less volatile? And don't mana bases make more sense when there are more decks, therefore you see less divergence in the price of the lands and stuff like that?
I would say the mana base. So I'm a little awkward position right here because I've been focusing a lot on MTGO the last couple of weeks because of this competition I'm in, and less so on like real world prices as far as that kind of stuff goes. But the mana bases obviously are always a sure bet. The problem with mana bases right now is it's not like Modern, where eventually every duel is going to be played at some point, so like you might as well pick them all up, right? There are some cards, like if I'm playing, you know, if I'm looking at green and white as aggressive colors, I'm not looking at that for control, I'm probably not picking up Canopy Vistas as heavily as I am picking up the new one. Whereas, and if I'm, you know, looking at blue-black, I probably want to be looking at a good mix of both. So I think you kind of tailor as to what you expect each color combination to be for standard. And beyond that, you probably also want to focus more on the staples. Like, I think your mana base is going to be so all over the place depending on if you're a two-color deck, a three-color deck, all these different pairings, as opposed to if you look and see how many decks are running a Chandra, you know, we see that there's a lot more of that happening. Because, you know, if you're in red, you're probably running that card right now. If you're in blue, there's a good chance you're running Jace. If you're in green, there's a good chance you're running Collected Company. And while that's not true for every deck, that is a good place to start. The problem is that these cards are so overpriced already, and some, I don't want to say overpriced, but so expensive in some cases already, that I think if you are just getting into it, it's a little daunting and difficult. I think you're better off picking up the staples from Shadows now and kind of going forward with that same mentality, but maybe not trying to, you know, pick up your Jaces from Origins at this point.
Yeah. And if you're playing Magic Online, like all the new Shadows lands, the hand lands, you could probably pick up a playset of each of them for about $20, 20 tickets.
Yeah, I picked up an entire playset this weekend for under 50 cents a piece for most of them. There was one point when they were all really low, and I just dove in for my personal playset. There was no way I could refuse paying $2 for a playset of those lands.
Yeah, this is...
Now, but what happens when they rotate? Let's say you pick up a playset of Canopy Vistas, you never played them, and all of a sudden they're not going to be as desirable in Modern, which is why it makes more sense to invest in something like a fetch land. What's your advice for people that are facing the prospect of potentially paying a lot of money for lands they might never use because the format rotated so fast that the decks that use those lands never even materialized?
Well, you need to be ready for that. And formats only rotate 6 months sooner than they would have. You're looking at this rotation, I mean, next time in the fall, like, we're still not losing Battle. Like, those will still be legal.
Right.
We don't lose Battle until this time next year. So you have a full year from now that Canopy Vista is playable. And on top of that, like, these cards, you're going to see a point in that year where if you decide you don't want to play with it, you can sell it for probably more than what you bought it for at some point throughout that year. It is more than likely there will be a deck that allows that to happen, or at least trade it out to a friend for what you paid for it or something like that. Like I said, that's why I'm not necessarily jumping on the Dragons cards or the Origins cards right this moment, because I think that's that window of opportunity that you're going to have to be able to move out of them if you decide you don't want to use them is very small. But I have no problem being on Battle or Oath cards right now.
Fabulous.
Yeah, so what do we think? Do we think there's any opportunities that came about from the Pro Tour here?
Honestly, I think watching the Pro Tour and being those quick in the dead scenarios, I think those are fewer and farther between. I know that TCG player has started to say, hey, watch your inventory over Pro Tour weekend because we're not going to let you cancel those orders. But I think some people just turn their inventory off, you know, just so they don't get hosed on those cards. I think there's too much volatility. There are too many people paying attention. There are too many people buying on a hair trigger. I don't think it's a thing anymore. Like, I wouldn't count on getting your order shipped to you, buying those seasons pass. And by the time you get them, if that deck doesn't materialize, like, they're just going to go back to right down close to where they were. And after all your shipping and everything, you're not really going to make anything. So I kind of don't like short-term stuff as much as I used to. It used to be fun to be like, oh, man, I'm watching coverage. I'm, you know, it's 3 a.m. here, but it's, you know, a reasonable time in Madrid. And I'm, you know, I'm paying attention because this is what I do. That used to be fun, and now it just sort of feels futile to me. So I paid attention, you know, but I didn't buy anything reactively. And I think buying reactively isn't a thing as much as it used to be.
Okay, so, well, but I mean, moving forward, what do we think?
I think the MTGO is the market to be in if you want to play that game, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the market, I made money on Cryptolith rights 3 separate times this weekend. That's not a thing you can do in real life. Like, that, I got to buy into them at 40 cents. I got out of them at like 3 something. I bought into them at $1.50. I got out of them at 3 something. And I bought into them at $1.50 again and got out of them at 3 something. Like,
so what are the advantages of the MTGO marketplace versus paper?
People are reactive. Uh-oh. Like literally all the cards went up, like Cryptolith Rite, you know, Seasons Pass. Yeah. You also saw
the market.
Westfield Abbey. They were all going down, and like they came quick. They came fastest. So if you were just a little bit ahead of the curve, you know, you could have wiped out the, you know, the bots and bought in, sell, get out and move. Like, especially before the pro tour, the whole week before the pro tour, if you spent your time just focusing on that, there's a lot of opportunity for you, but you really got to focus in on it.
And even if you don't, I noticed, I mean, this is the first time I've done this and I'm already noticing trends. And this is like without a whole lot of like outside opinion or anything. I read a couple of articles, just kind of get a general idea of what was going to happen. But I know like Friday night, what happened is like as coverage is going, anytime there's a deck tech or something like that, you can expect any card in that deck tech to spike immediately. And then on top of that, you have like anything that sees camera play, especially things that win on camera, any major card that had like an impactful turn in the game, things like that you kind of want to watch. But then as coverage trails off for the day, which happened to be, you know, about 3-4 o'clock here, you'll see the cards start spiking pretty heavily right then. Any cards that hadn't spiked already, it will start spiking pretty heavily. Seasons Pass is a great example. Seasons Pass Saturday after, you know, it was announced it was going to make top 8. They spiked to like $16. Well, everything else in the set has to like account for that because there is still, I mean, it doesn't hold quite as fast as it would normally because like prices will vary a little bit, but overall that set's price still has to have like a total value. And so Avacyn dropped down because the Seasons Pass went up, and
about $20.
I looked at that. I saw Avacyn hit 18 tickets after it had just been 40 the week before, and even 35 all weekend up until that point. I have no idea why it tanked 18. And I was like, well, shoot, I don't know if this is right or not, but I can't imagine that like Seasons Pass should be 16 and Avacyn be 18. That like Seasons Pass is a 2 of in one deck. Avacyn is, you know, this. And I was like, I'm just going to buy into a playset of these and see how that goes. It could be 12 in the morning and I could feel awful, or it could be, you know, way more. And the other card I looked at was Narset because everyone was talking about all these other decks, and Esper Control hadn't really gotten a whole lot of camera time yet. And then I actually bought those earlier on Saturday, I think. But like Narset was another one where like within the course of 4 or 5 hours, I was able to flip them for like a 3-ticket, 4-ticket profit. And Avacyn in less than 24 hours, I doubled up on, which again, is not something you can do in real life. Like, but you just have to know how to look for those trends. The other problem is if you get in on a card, especially a card like under $1, thinking it could go up, if it doesn't, you're pretty much out all your money because those cards will go down to absolutely nothing. So like my Fevered Visions that I bought at like nearly $1 thinking they would go up because they're good in the metagame, that didn't pan out. No deck's really top aided with it. That card's like 30 some cents now, and there's no way I'm getting my money back out of that. So I'm just going to hold them for a while.
So Moto Finance 101, it's like a zero lag marketplace. Like, you're not waiting for physical copies to come to you in the mail, and you're not waiting to send them off in the mail. You know, the bot buys and the bot sales are instantaneous, which
margins
means
are also insane.
Yeah,
the market can be way more volatile because like you're in and out of your positions like the real stock market. There's not that time. There's not that restocking, that, you know, that slow, hey, the cards came in the mail, I'm going to grade them, get back to you, blah, blah, blah. It's stuff's instantaneous. And I think that's one of the reasons why the prices can be so volatile, because, you know, if you haven't even if a card sells out of a store, they're not going to reprice it 3 or 4 times while they're waiting for people to buy list those copies in the mail, you know, or they haven't even been sent out to people yet. They're not going to get repriced because it takes there's like a cycle built into how often the card's price changes. And it's based on, you know, what price it sells out at and stuff like that. So Moto, you can see a lot more volatility. And I think that's one of the advantages. Being able to get in and out of positions instantaneously means that you can be a lot ballsier.
Well, and you don't have to see nearly the market shifts that you would have to see in real life either. So, I mean, something like Cryptolith Rites. Say I bought into Cryptolith Rites at $1.50 in real life, and it goes up to $3.50. The amount of money I can actually make off of that is almost nothing. Because by the time I buy list it, it's going to be for, what, $2 maybe? And that's assuming I can find a pretty good buy list on it. Then I got to pay for shipping and all the other stuff, plus all the time it took me to get those and then have to send them back out and hoping that that CryptoList rates is still $3.50 or whatever. Whereas in Modo, you buy something for $1.50, it's $3.50, you're going to sell it for $3.25. So because that margin is so much smaller, there's a lot more opportunity to make gains on cards that don't necessarily have to spike a ton in order to make money on where you would in real life. You can make a lot of money off of like smaller trades.
All right. I don't know enough about Modo Finance to really advocate for it, but I think it's good to see Ryan getting into it. That's something Marcel knows pretty well. And that was something
I don't know it pretty well. I do not. Don't lie. Do not lie. Please do not lie. I really don't. I just pay barely enough attention.
Hey, you were the guy for years on this podcast.
And that's how quick I got eclipsed. You take a real finance guy and you pay attention to magic online is really not that difficult.
I bet you pick it right back up.
Sure. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Cause I sold out. I sold out a bunch of my magic online collection. I got rid of at least like a 30%, 35% of everything I held on Magic Online. Sold it to tickets. Oh. I'm cashing out.
Oh, man. I've been really enjoying it because I haven't really put a lot of money into Magic Online before this. But with this 500 tickets, which I now have up to like 700 and some tickets, I've got like a playset at Jace's just sitting there. I'm waiting for him to go up. And I was like, in the meantime, I might as well build this Fevered Visions deck and play with these Jace's that I've never been able to own before. This is sweet.
I'm not out completely on Magic Online. Don't get that wrong. I just sold a good percentage of what I had just because I don't know. The new Cox is talking about a new game platform for Magic. Who knows where that could lead? If that turns out to be something that they'll pull the rug from underneath you. If you don't pull the rug underneath the pros, they'll pull the rug underneath Magic Online and without a heartbeat. So.
You just think they're going to completely like pull Magic Online and make a new program?
Honestly, business-wise, that may be the best thing they could do.
They wouldn't just say that your collection doesn't exist if they did that.
They'll probably have some way to transfer it.
You'd be able to port your stuff over.
Yeah, but your value would not. You may be able to port the cards, but the value wouldn't be there. You may be able to have these cards and your Black Lotuses and everything.
Oh, you're saying it would turn to like a...
The value could plummet. The actual dollar value could plummet. What your cards are worth in Magic Online currency or something.
It depends on how they transition it. If they transition it so it's like, okay, this is the new Magic Online. We couldn't integrate it with the old Magic Online. So what you do is they could set some sort of code or something where it's just like, okay, you log in from this account. It's going to take a while to transfer over the file, or maybe you have to take the file from Magic Online and like place it into something. I don't know. There's some way they could do it so that it would update all of your current collection into this new program. And then all you're doing essentially is you've rerouted how Magic Online works. You still keep all your collection. The whole marketplace would stay exactly the same. Like, Magic Online is kind of like the real world market at this point. Like, there's so many people invested for so many thousands of dollars that
they're not just going to pull it entirely.
Yeah, like I have a tough time buying that.
No, I'm not saying that they're going to pull it entirely, but their actions made me enough nervous that I don't want to be deep into the
Marcel's
program.
All doomsday preppers over here with his magic.
Hey, I
can
still
you trade your Magic Online collection for canned food and tinfoil hats.
I'm still deep in standard. I'm deep in standard. I bought Jace's. I've been on a roller coaster with Jace's on Magic Online.
In paper?
No, Magic Online. Like it went up. I got it at 60. It went up to 90. Then it was going down, so I got rid of it at 65, and then it shot back up again, so I got back in at 75. Then it went down to 50. Now it's back up to 60.
You're like teaching us how to lose money.
Oh my God, yeah. Jace has been.
I bought it at 75. That was the cheapest I found them, and I'm pretty happy with getting in at that price.
It was horrible. Like the roller coaster with Jace has made me hate Magic for a little bit, and I just want to get out. I just want to get most of my money back. If anything, hopefully some. This has been sad, and it's been like, oh man, it made me feel like I'm really bad at this shit because like I'm buying in it at all the wrong times and selling it at all the wrong times.
You know what? You're buying like a player, and like I don't have a problem with that.
Well, Magic Online is so interesting because like in this conversation we just had about people losing the value of their cards on there. If you ever see any of these complaints, and Marcel, is one of those people who, has a big problem with prices, understandably. But a lot of people, whenever this comes up, say, I don't care if my cards go to zero value. all I care about is more people playing Magic. But now when we talk about a new Magic Online client, which would lead to more people playing Magic because it's much better, all of a sudden people are like, oh, I care about the value of my cards. I can't lose the money I've invested into this.
I mean, there's a difference between one or two of your cards, like, dropping in value because they reprint them, and your entire collection, which you've invested thousands and thousands of dollars into, becoming suddenly worth $0.
I don't disagree with you, but that is not the... That is just definitively not prevailing sentiment.
No, see, if my collection...
like legacy players, right?
No,
like,
every time this comes up, people say, I don't care if my modern deck or my legacy deck tomorrow was worth $100 if it meant more people playing with me. And now we have the conversation about Magic Online, and we do care. Hold on.
No, I made this statement, and I do feel this way. If my collection that I'm currently holding on to, because I didn't sell everything, all of a sudden... dropped in value, but then Magic Online became better. I would be bitter, obviously. I lost a lot of money, but I ultimately would get over that because I made the decision to still be into Magic Online for as deep as I am. The big dilemma would be like, you know, me right now knowing that if that were to happen and I didn't do anything about it and I could have, then that would eat me alive. You know, that decision right there. Is the one that would make more of it that I would be like, you know what? Let me at least not let that hurt as bad as it could hurt. Let me not just give up thousands of dollars for this company that really doesn't care about me.
But we all agree though that is the prevailing sentiment is that people, you say, yeah, I'll get over it. But we all agree that people would lose their minds, right? Like,
well, yeah, who wouldn't?
I mean, but it's just so
if people are losing their minds about pros losing $2,700 every 3 months. You know, like, they're not going to be pissed if they lose $10,000 instantly.
I just wanted to point out I don't want to necessarily use the word hypocrisy, but those statements don't jive. Like, I don't care if I lose money unless. Well, you know, I guess I do care, though.
I hear where you're coming from, Corbin. You were.
He got you.
No,
you're correct.
I'm not trying to get anybody. I just want it to be, you know, it's relevant, and it obviously comes up every couple months. People talking about it. So
I'm still in favor.
Don't expect people to ever be rational vis-a-vis MTG Finance. It's a party they're not invited to, and they're gonna get butt hurt. Like, if things go well for us or if things go poorly for us, like, it's just going to happen. Like, people are going to be upset because we're making money and they see it as it making the game more expensive for them.
I'm still in favor of subscription-based Magic Online. I think that's the future, honestly. But that's just me.
I'm with you. I mean, that sounds probably less profitable for them unless they made the subscription prohibitively expensive, but I'm on board with that plan.
No, I think you just make subscription-based standard leagues or modern, whatever the PTQ season is. Like, we talked about this before. Like, I think that's a great way to handle it while not completely shitting on the marketplace. Like, you're still going to have people want to play dailies, leagues, all that stuff. But if you want to play for the PTQ or if you want to play for the Pro Tour invite, then there's a separate league where you can play monthly. You can have access to the entire standard collection, but you can only play it within that league. And that would be a good way to handle it without completely destroying what you've already built. Just like I think with this, they need to, with the whole the whole platinum thing that's going on right now, they need to reinstate the invitational and give the pros like that big tournament where it's like, okay, if you're a platinum pro, you get to go, you get to play, throw more money on the line just for that. So it doesn't, you know, then you don't have to worry about we're paying people to be, you know, platinum or whatever. It's like, no, you're just invited to a tournament where you get to make some extra cash. And then you get your, you know, they really need to reinstate people creating a card. I don't understand why Magic isn't doing that. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
You went from we're talking about the financial flight to, let's just give them a card. I don't think that's that big.
They should get a card.
I mean, that's part of the whole invitational appeal back in the day was like the winner got to create their own card. And that was awesome. Like, I understand there was issues from, like, you know, the pros always want to create these like super powerful cards and whatnot. But even if it's like, okay, you don't get to create the card, but we're going to take your picture and we're going to put your likeliness on a card in the next set, that would be fine.
Like, and then we're going to reprint it and make you an old black lady.
Sure. But something to immortalize yourself in the game, I think would be awesome. But yeah, I mean, that's my rant. I think there's a number of things that could be done better. I think that Wizards is not doing the worst, horrible, awful job that everyone's making them out to be on this particular Monday. But they definitely screwed the pooch today.
Right. Okay, so let's do pick of the week before we jump on out of here.
If you're not sure what to do, better ask the Rachel Brewery Crew for their pick of the week.
I'll jump in. It's something that I actually did see quite a bit of at the Pro Tour and financially has not moved, and that is Drownyard Temple out of Shadows of Runeterra. You can find these for under $2. I mean, honestly, there's a bunch at $1.50 or below on TCG Player, and the card is a four of and a bunch of decks. It makes a lot of these discard decks work. It's good value. It's great long term. And, you know, it's not cheap right now, but it's not falling either. And it's sort of plateaued. And with how much standard play it's seen, if it's still seeing play anything like this a year from now, it's going to be a $5 card. And long term, I think it's a $5 to $10 card anyways. So I'm a big fan of Drownyard Temple at the current $2 price.
Don't buy it yet. Wait until they announce the full deck list for the Commander 2016.
You think it could sink in
there? I think it's going to be – yeah, I think so. This is a good Grimgrin engine. It's a good Sidisi engine. We're getting a blue-black deck for sure, right? So I think this could be
– I believe you.
That's what it's going to be. So there's a good chance that the utility land they put in there isn't a new one, because, like, how often can they keep pulling new ones out of their butt? Arcane Lighthouse and Myriad Landscape. I think there's a real good possibility that there's a Drownyard Temple in the deck. So,
okay, so
if there's not, then yeah, maybe you just wait until it's ruled out in there, because that's if it's not reprinted there, I think the reprint risk goes down about 90%. So I like it if it's not in that deck.
How much lower can it go from $2? It seems, you know, a lot of standard play.
I mean, look at some of the Commander 2015 and 2016 stuff that just went to poop, you know. So unless the blue-black deck is insane, it probably won't go down too much. If the deck's insane, then like it almost won't matter, just because there'll be every copy of that deck gets snapped up. But I think they've gotten better at making the decks on parity with each other. So they're all roughly going to be bought at about the same rate, and therefore there's no true name nemesis like there was before.
Right, right. We agree on that. I mean, yeah, and I guess that's fair. Something like High Market from Commander is just above a buck. Command Tower is just above a buck. So it could kill it pretty hard.
Yeah.
But either way, I guess that's true. I mean, maybe wait a little bit on that, but I still like this card a lot. And
oh, I do too.
There's
I'm
no
just
guarantee
saying,
that it doesn't creep
mitigate
up over
reprint
the next
risk.
Month. Yeah.
There's no rush to buy in, so why not mitigate like the only source of reprint risk I can see?
I mean, that's true. I mean, I do think there is some reprint risk simply because it is getting heavy standard. Or I think that there is some risk of it going up in price in the short term because it is seeing a lot of standard play. But I think on average, you're probably right. Wait to see the list.
Yeah, I mean, there was more Drownyards than there was Westvale Abbeys in Top 8, right? Or at least the number was very close, and one of those cards is far more expensive than the other. I understand that, like, being a flip card obviously does impact that, and it is definitely rarer, technically, than the Drownyard is in packs, but I don't know that it is as much rarer than
the wrong card?
Price.
Are you talking about the card in Standard that's, like, 3 mana to bring it back from the graveyard?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, there's no way this isn't Commander 2016. Don't. I thought you were talking about the blue black thing that milled you for like 3.
Oh, you're talking about Nephalia's Drownyard.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Ignore me. There's no way that the Drownyard Temple is in a Commander deck.
Oh,
and
no,
honestly,
no.
I think the Gitrog monster.
It's like genius if it is.
Yeah, the Gitrog monster is making that get played in EDH. So I think that some of the playability, some of it at least. Past its standard, but I don't know how much upside there is. But I still don't hate the pick. But yeah, ignore what I said about the reprint risk before, because that's not happening.
I mean, there's still some reprint risk. Like, you're not wrong; it does fit in a graveyard based deck.
I think it's a little too new.
I wouldn't actually be surprised to see that. Well, you say that, but then didn't Commander 15 have like cards in it that were actually still in standard? So I don't think it's impossible. Like everything you were saying sounded fairly reasonable to me. So,
well, and hey, pretend I got the right card then.
Yeah, even though you weren't necessarily talking about that card, I think it is still technically a risk there. But I think you're also right in the sense that if it's not in that product, you mitigate about 90% of your risk of that being reprinted anytime soon, because it's not really like you're going to shoehorn that in something else.
Yeah, okay, so wait then. I feel like I got another card that I think you wait on, but I think you can start picking these up in trade because they're never really going to get cheaper. And it's just another one of those cards that's like, wow, this is analogous to a card that gets played in EDH that you would run both copies, and one of the copies is older and super expensive, and the new one, just because it's in standard, is worth nothing. From Beyond. It's the new Awakening Zone that you can actually crack open and go get an Eldrazi. The card's like 90 cents. Like, it's not good. Yeah, get as many as you can. You know how many I got hundreds of copies of Dictate of Erebos at a quarter, and it was such a minimal investment, and the card's like $3 right now. And it was super obvious. Everybody knew it was going to happen, but like nobody did anything about it. And they're kicking themselves now, like, why didn't I buy these? I'm like, I don't know, because you knew it was going to go up, because Grave Pack was like $12, and this is like 50 cents. It's a no-brainer. I feel like From Beyond, it's 4 mana instead of the 3 mana from Awakening Zone, which I feel is mitigated by the fact that it makes a 1-1 instead of a 0-1, and you can crack it for an Eldrazi. Like, From Beyond is just nuts. It's an EDH, like, auto-include. Like, any deck that was running Awakening Zone wants this, so it's not going to be 90 cents. You look at Awakening Zone, it's got multiple reprintings, and it's still over $3. Like, this is a slam dunk. And the thing is, it's going to take over a year for it to go up. So, like, you can spend... Every time you see one in a binder, you can snatch it out. Every time you see one in a dollar bin in a store, you can grab it. You have so much time to accumulate as many copies of this as you want. Don't buy on TCG Player. Just pick these up slowly. Don't trigger the market, because if you trigger the market, the price is it's not going to end up correct. You know, it'll surge up and it'll go back down and it'll just go nuts. So just be thinking in the back of your mind, like, this is a long-term card. I want to slowly accumulate these. I want to pick these up out of every binder. You know, this will be the play, like, hey, do you have From Beyond when you sit down to trade with somebody? That'll be your entree card into their binder. And just trade for these. Agreed. Don't pay cash for these yet. Just wait. But this is a $3 card, you know, for 90 cents or cheaper.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I got to play it in the Crypto with Rights, like, Aristocrats deck I was playing around with last weekend or whatnot. And it was a lot of fun in that deck, too. I ran a one of Ulamog and a one of Kozilek to go search for. So even at standard, this card potentially has implications. I wouldn't be surprised to see it start seeing sideboard play in some of those rights variants. It's definitely a powerful engine to be able to beat some of the decks that are a little bit rougher matchup.
Otherwise, but even, I don't think standard short term has the, ironically, I don't think standard short term has the power to spike it like EDH long term can.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I definitely don't think it will, but I mean, it's just another positive for that card if it sees any standard play.
That seems like a negative, because it makes it harder to pick up reasonably.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, I would probably go after your copies now rather than waiting for it too long. It's one of those cards where, I mean, you've got another year of it being in standard. There is certainly a plausibility of it seeing play within that year.
Actually, the one that... So this is an effect that happens sometimes. The second spike on a card is usually a lot less smooth. And the hypothesis for that is the first spike gets people to go into their collections and their shoeboxes and stuff like that, and all these copies come out of the woodwork and get concentrated in the hands of dealers. So when the card spikes the second time, it's mostly dealers that got them. People aren't being like, oh, I've got one of those in a deck. It's every copy, you know, is the loose copies are mostly dried up, and so people have to buy them from dealers, and therefore the price changes are more profound because it's dealers getting bought out. So if it did spike because of standard, it would spike much quicker the second time, once EDH goes, hey, this card's actually nuts. And I fully expect the white green Commander 2016 deck to be a token theme, but I think it's less likely that From Beyond would be in there, and more likely that Awakening Zone would be in there. Maybe that you don't get either. Maybe it's like Glare of Subdual or something in that spot. So
All right, who wants to go next?
Well, you already went, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay. So, I think Marcel has left us for the evening, by the sounds of it. So, my pick is actually an MTGO pick, as, like I said, that's most of what I followed this weekend. It is Worldbreaker. This card is $5.50 on MTGO. That is in a major response to all of the other cards from Oath going up, particularly Kalidus, which hit 25 over the weekend. Worldbreaker was in a top 8 deck. However, it was fairly overshadowed by everything else going on. It lost in the first round. So we didn't really get to see the card, you know, take off like a lot of the other cards did. Nissa took off, obviously, because it was in the winning deck, and that kind of held the price, you know, down on Worldbreaker. And as of today, Nissa started to drop a little bit. We're seeing Chandra climb back up a little bit, but that also didn't really do that great in the top eight, so that price was kind of down. But I think that we're going to see Worldbreaker kind of crawl back up as well over the course of the next week or two, and I wouldn't be surprised to see Worldbreaker kind of make a resurgence as well, because it's good against a lot of these decks that were in the top eight. It's a good way to deal with goggles and stuff like that, that some decks have a difficult time dealing with main deck. And so I think that's a great place to be right now for 550 for a mythic that's definitely going to see play and still has another year in standard.
Okay.
That's not a card I hate long term either. Worldbreaker's just a silly idiot card.
Very, very good in modern as well. All right, well, there you go, guys. Pick of the week, Pro Tour, drama, everything you want in an episode of Brainstorm Brewery. So thanks for sticking around. No Marcel to outro you this week, but we will be back next week. So keep sending us those emails. And if you're interested in helping us plan episode 200 by listening to some old ones, shoot us an email at brainstormbrew.com. So until next week, we're Brainstorm Brewery. Thank you for listening.
I think you meant brainstormbrew@gmail.
That's what I meant. I was so close to nailing that outro.
Yeah, man.
It's hard. It's a hard life.
Well, we're not going to let you do it again. Like, you got one shot and you blew it.
I see.
Yeah, it's probably fair. Done now.
That's fair.
It's fine. Yeah. We'll just have to make sure Marcel's on for every episode ever now.
Yeah, man. So he wouldn't have screwed that up. Again. Marcel's a professional.